Chapter 3. Conquest and Culture. Now, if there be a fact to which all experience testifies, it is that when a country holds another in subjection, the individuals of the ruling people think the people of the country mere dirt under their feet. John Stuart Mill. The history of conquest constitutes much of the history of the human race. The conquerors of one era are often the conquered of another. Ancient Rome imposed its yoke from Britain to North Africa and the Middle East, yet Rome itself has also been conquered many times by foreigners, its treasures looted, its people tortured, its women raped, and the defenseless slaughtered. Much the same story could be told of the rise and fall of the great Chinese dynasties, the Islamic empires, the vast domains of Genghis Khan, and other ancient and modern conquerors. Conquest and subjugation are among the ugliest aspects of the human experience. Pyramids of the heads of the slain were regularly presented as gifts to the sultans of the Ottoman Empire, these heads sometimes numbering in the thousands and representing defenseless prisoners, while ordinary Ottoman soldiers divided among themselves the women and boys of the conquered peoples for their own sexual amusement. Among the conquering Bemba tribe in pre-colonial Africa, it was common for chiefs to have singers and drummers whose eyes had been gouged out to prevent their running away. In the Western Hemisphere, the Aztecs used thousands of prisoners of war for human sacrifices, some having their hearts torn out and others being burned alive. The sadistic tortures of the Romans included skinning people alive, boiling them in water or oil, and applying red-hot metal to various parts of their naked bodies. During the infamous Bataan Death March of World War II, Japanese soldiers forced captured American soldiers to kill each other, sometimes by burying their friends alive. Yet with all the horrors of conquest, the world we live in today is a world shaped by historic conquests and their cultural consequences. Cultural diffusion. The very words we use and the framework within which we think are shaped by cultural patterns spread by force in centuries past. Much of modern Europe is a cultural heir of the Roman Empire, and its languages offshoots of Latin. Other European languages, such as German and Slavic, prevail in a geographic pattern established by conquests of the 5th and 6th centuries. The Islamic conquests during Europe's Dark Ages were an important source of light, bringing advances in mathematics, science, and philosophy to Europe from a vast domain that reached from the Indian subcontinent to the Atlantic Ocean. So-called Arabic numerals originated, in fact, among the Hindus of India, though the misnomer reveals the source through which this numbering system reached Western civilization. The conquest of Spain by the Muslims in the 8th century was especially important, as Spain became for centuries thereafter a center of diffusion into Northern and Western Europe of the more advanced knowledge of the Mediterranean world and of the Orient in astronomy, medicine, optics, geometry, printing, and geography. Even the philosophy of ancient Greece often reached Western Europe in Arabic translations, which were in turn retranslated in Spain into Latin or into the vernacular languages of Western Europe. The later rise of Northern and Western Europe to world preeminence in science and technology, built directly on these cultural foundations, brought to them by Muslim conquerors. In modern times, the most advanced science and technology has been spread by Europe's own conquests throughout the world, as well as by migrations and other means. Half the planet, the Western Hemisphere, is a cultural product of 4 centuries of European imperialism. The great Chinese Empire lasted far longer, but for understanding today's racial and cultural relationships, the European impact is a more immediate concern, not only in the Western Hemisphere, but in Asia and Africa as well. Not all conquests have been culturally meaningful, however, much less culturally beneficial. At one extreme, there have been wars of extermination, such as that of Rome against Carthage, in which cultural consequences were minimal and confined to those few who somehow managed to survive. Other conquests, for the more usual goals of extracting wealth from the conquered peoples, may not have lasted long enough to be culturally meaningful. When the Nazis occupied much of France for 4 years during World War II, that had little or no permanent impact on the French way of life after the war was over. Neither French cuisine nor the particular fields of endeavor in which Frenchmen excelled was changed by this painful period in the history of France. Many other conquests have likewise had little or no cultural effect, whether because of the brief duration of the conquest or because the conquerors had only limited aims, such as control of a strategic port, establishing military bases, extracting minerals, or extorting tribute in various ways that left the cultural life of the conquered peoples largely untouched. It must also be recognized that some conquests have done more to destroy an existing culture than to spread a new one. In ancient times especially, conquest by mounted barbarians had ruinous impacts on early agriculturally based civilizations. Later in history, wanton destruction of great libraries in conquered lands was especially devastating in an era of handwritten scrolls, many of them irreplaceable. The conquering Vandals have left their name as a generic term of disgrace, but many other conquerors have also delighted in destruction, quite aside from those who deliberately sought to stamp out the cultures of the conquered peoples when they had nothing better with which to replace it. If one looks far enough back through history, virtually all peoples have been conquered peoples. But a study of race and culture is concerned with those conquests which have made a cultural difference in the lives and history of the conquered and the conquerors. Before ancient Britain was invaded and conquered by the Roman legions, not a single Briton had ever done anything to leave his name in the pages of history. It was only after the coming of the Romans that buildings were constructed for the first time in Britain. Roads were also built by the Romans, towns developed, agricultural methods advanced, and sculpture and representational art in general spread. In Churchill's words, "We owe London to Rome." The contributions of Roman civilization to Britain were perhaps even more dramatically demonstrated by the consequences of the withdrawal of the Roman legions in the 5th century AD to return to the continent to defend the declining empire against its enemies there. By the beginning of the 6th century, British towns were crumbling, with buildings and statues in ruins. Roadways and waterways fell into disrepair, and in some places wild vegetation, including forests, began to reclaim what had been human settlements. The dead began to be buried more crudely than before, often without coffins and in shallower graves. The governmental structure, which had unified most of the island under the Romans, now fragmented into tribal domains, too weak and disorganized to withstand marauders and invaders from continental Europe. Britain was not unique in its retrogressions after the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. On the continent as well, cities declined and in some places disappeared. Such goods as pottery, cloth, and metal products were more poorly made than in Roman times. An estimated 1,000 years passed before the material standard of living in Europe rose again to the level achieved under the Romans. As late as the early 19th century, no city in Europe had as dependable a water supply as many European cities had had in the days of the Roman Empire. Where cultural transfers occur as a result of prolonged subjugation of peoples less advanced than their conquerors, ambivalence has been one of the dominant notes of such conquests. More advanced conquerors have been hated, admired, imitated, and killed. Often the ambivalence has been present within given individuals, as well as representing widely differing reactions among different groups among the conquered peoples. British rule in India produced much ambivalence on both sides, continuing long after independence. Some Puerto Ricans have made desperate terrorist efforts to gain their island's independence from the United States, a goal resoundingly defeated at the polls by their fellow Puerto Ricans, both in a plebiscite on that specific issue, and in regular elections among political parties advocating various statuses for Puerto Rico. In Wales, even home rule has been rejected at the polls by the Welsh, though Welsh nationalists have engaged in vandalism and sporadic terror in opposition to the union with England, and some Welsh intellectuals have complained bitterly of English political and cultural hegemony. During the colonial era in Africa, many Africans who saw European civilization as a liberating advance over traditional indigenous culture nevertheless resented the racism that came with it. To be called boy, to have to stand in queues and let any white person go ahead, signs for whites only, these things scarred and angered Africans, especially the educated ones. Similar and sometimes worse things happened to many other conquered peoples, whether they were racially distinct from the conquerors or physically indistinguishable. Cromwell's slaughters and mass confiscations of land in Ireland, and the oppressive and degrading laws which fastened second-class status on the Irish for more than a century thereafter, were all too typical of what other conquerors have done. The oppressions of various indigenous peoples in the Western Hemisphere by other indigenous peoples preceded the arrival of Columbus and may help explain many American Indian tribes' decisions to join with the new race from Europe in attacking their erstwhile oppressors. To attempt to add up a total of the net advantages and disadvantages of conquest would be a staggering task. Two learned authorities on the history of colonialism declare, "It is hard to make general statements with regard to even a single territory under the sway of any one colonial power." When another scholar referred to the Germans as having produced in their colony in the Cameroon numerous public works and numerous acts of brutality, he was saying something that could be said of many colonial powers, from ancient to modern times. What is somewhat clear is that those peoples conquered longer and more thoroughly subjected to the cultural hegemony of more advanced societies have tended themselves to excel in the economic and cultural realms in which the conquerors have had an advantage. It was precisely the southeastern part of Britain, England, that was conquered earliest and most thoroughly incorporated into the Roman Empire, which developed into the most advanced part of the British Isles. Centuries later, during the colonial era in India and Ceylon, members of the same racial or ethnic groups developed very different levels of skills, education, and economic initiative, according to whether they lived for long under the direct rule of the British or in regions that held out as independent regions. Even after India achieved independence, the Indras, who had lived under British rule, proved to be overwhelming competition for the Telanganans, who had lived under Indian princes, though racially and in most cultural aspects they were the same people. Similarly, in Sri Lanka, those Sinhalese who lived in regions conquered earlier by the British continued generations later to outperform their fellow Sinhalese from Kandyan Highlands that remained independent longer. Other highlands, from Scotland to Southeast Asia, allowed indigenous upland peoples to hold out longer in independent and backward enclaves. Cultural receptivity. Even where various groups within a conquered country have all been subjected to or given access to the culture of the conquerors, the receptivity to that culture has often varied radically. Sometimes there has been a deliberate decision to remain removed from the new culture, as when Muslim groups in various African and Asian countries under European colonial rule refused to become involved in the schools and other institutions set up by Christian missionaries there. In many cases, missionary schools were the only schools, so that those outside the missionary school system were permanently handicapped in all competitions requiring skills and education, whether in clerical occupations, the medical or legal professions, in the military officer corps, or in scientific or engineering fields. Throughout the colonial area in Nigeria, for example, the vast majority of the Western educated Nigerians were from the southern region of the country, while the majority of the population lived in the predominantly Muslim north. As of 1912, for example, there were fewer than 1,000 students in elementary school in northern Nigeria, compared to more than 35,000 in the rest of the country. A quarter of a century later, there were still fewer than 100 secondary school students receiving Western education in the northern region, compared to more than 4,200 in the rest of Nigeria. Such educational disparities had enduring consequences. Of 160 Nigerian physicians in the country in the early 1950s, only one was from the House of Fulani people, who were dominant in the north, while there were 49 Igbos and 76 Yorubas from the southern regions of the country. In the army, three-quarters of the riflemen were House of Fulani, while four-fifths of the officers were southerners. As late as 1965, one-half of Nigeria's officer corps were Igbos, a historically less prosperous group which had seized upon Western education to advance themselves. Even within northern Nigeria, southern Nigerians dominated many occupations requiring education, skills, or entrepreneurship. Nigeria was by no means unique in such disparities, or in the rearrangement of group rankings in the wake of cultural transformations wrought by colonial rule. In colonial Ceylon, the Tamil minority, located in the less fertile northern tip of the island, seized upon Western education to a far greater extent than the Sinhalese majority, who, as Buddhists, were resistant to Christian missionary education. As of 1921, there were more physicians from the Tamil minority than from the Sinhalese majority. As of 1942, the Ceylon Tamils, who were 11% of the population, were more than 30% of all the students in Ceylon University College. In 1945, on the eve of independence, the Tamils were 30% of the civil servants and held 40% of the judicial posts in the country. The superior educational achievements of the Tamils continued on into the post-independence era. As of 1969, in what was now the independent nation of Sri Lanka, the Tamil minority provided 40% of all university students in the sciences, including 48% in engineering and 49% in medicine. Both in Nigeria and in Sri Lanka, the success of upstart minorities provoked political backlashes, group quotas, mob violence, and ultimately civil war. All except civil war have also resulted from similar situations in Malaysia, Fiji, and several states in India. In other countries as well, different groups among the conquered have responded very differently to the new cultural and economic opportunities created by incorporation into a larger or more advanced nation. Wales, Ireland, and Scotland all advanced economically after being incorporated into the United Kingdom, but only Scotland developed its own entrepreneurial and technological class, rather than having Englishmen fill these roles in its economy. In the Soviet Union, Russian technical experts were sent into various republics to run the more advanced parts of their economies, but Armenia used its own technical experts and even exported some to other parts of the USSR. What was said of the ancient Britons in Roman times was much more widely applicable, that these Britons learnt from Rome not the lessons she was able to teach, but the lessons their previous training enabled them to learn. In short, conquered peoples are not a blank slate on which the conqueror's culture writes its message. The receptivity of the receiving culture is a vital part of the cultural transfer. Conquest has not only brought more advanced technologies and more sophisticated modes of thought to some new areas, it has expanded the cultural universe in general. More has been involved than a transfer of things and ideas. Cultural insularity has been shattered. Any belief that existing ways of doing things are the only ways becomes palpably untenable. All within the expanded domains become players on a larger stage. Less advanced peoples within this large cultural universe have not only acquired the benefits of a more sophisticated culture, but also, in many cases, have eventually become contributors to its further development. Thus, the peoples of the Yangtze River Valley contributed to the development of the Chinese civilization, which had begun earlier in the Yellow River Valley. In a later era, after the conquest of Scotland by the English and the English language and culture, the Scots did not simply imitate the English, but themselves eventually forged to the forefront of British culture and world civilization in many fields in the 18th century, producing such landmark figures as David Hume in philosophy, Adam Smith in economics, Joseph Black in chemistry, and James Watt, who developed the epoch-making steam engine. More broadly, the Scots forged past the English in industrial engineering and created one of the leading medical schools of the world, whose graduates created some of the earliest medical schools in colonial America, where Scots were also two-thirds of the colonial governors. Conquerors, as well as conquered, have been culturally transformed. When Arabs transmitted the cultures of Asia, of Hellenistic Greece, and of Persia a millennium ago, they not only transformed those cultures, but were themselves transformed. Conquest has spread more advanced cultures, not just to those peoples directly conquered, but also to independent peoples in the same geographical regions, to which the cultural advances have been further diffused by trade, migration, and the general transmission of knowledge, whether by formal education or through informal contacts. Artifacts of Roman civilization reached Britain, for example, well before the Roman conquest of the island, and also reached other countries and regions which Rome never conquered, such as Poland, Scandinavia, and the Baltic. In a later era as well, cultural artifacts were spread by conquest beyond the borders of the lands actually conquered. In other ways, the cultural consequences of conquest have not been limited to direct transfers from conquerors to the conquered. Often the conquerors have been conduits for cultural advantages that originated with other peoples or in other lands. Much of the culture spread by the Arab conquests, for example, did not originate with people who were themselves Arabs. Many of these cultural features were the material or intellectual products of other societies encompassed by the vast Islamic Empire, or were the products of individuals and groups, including Christians and Jews, within the orbit of the Arab conquests. The cultural artifacts diffused by the Arab conquests also included products known within the empire, which originated outside the empire, such as paper and printing from China, which were transmitted through the Islamic world to Western Europe, enabling mass-produced books to replace costly handwritten scrolls with revolutionary implications for the wide diffusion of knowledge. The Arabic language created a common medium facilitating the transmission of culture across vast distances and throughout an enlarged cultural universe, promoting new advances. Much the same story could be told of the modern era, when European empires brought not only the fruits of European culture, much of its beginnings borrowed from other civilizations, but also European languages that spanned the globe and reached back in time for thousands of years with the thoughts of both European and non-European thinkers, all now available in modern translation. Conquest has not only expanded the universe through which ideas, products, and technologies could move, but has also led to massive redistributions of the peoples of the world. Nor has this redistribution of peoples been limited to the conquerors themselves. Historic as such invasions have been, whether of the Mongols and the Turks into Europe and the Middle East, or of Europeans into the Western Hemisphere and Australia. Both the ravages of war and the subsequent benefits of pacification have spread other populations, neither conquerors nor conquered, far from their lands of origin. The havoc and chaos of war raging through ancient China sent refugees fleeing to adjoining lands, where they spread the Chinese culture. In other instances, and in other eras, the pacification of large regions under the conqueror's hegemony has enabled other peoples to settle in places where they would never have dared to settle before, among indigenous peoples whose wrath or spoliation they could not have risked before. While there was some movement of immigrants from China or India into Southeast Asia before European imperialists established colonies there, the vast majority of such immigration of Chinese and Indians into regions inhabited by Malays and Indonesians occurred after European hegemony was established in the region. Likewise, in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, it would have been fatal for members of some tribes to go settle in regions inhabited by other tribes until after the Europeans had established control over them all. Much of the commerce and industry of whole regions of the planet was created by these large-scale migrations, whether of Chinese into Southeast Asia, Indians into East Africa, Germans and Italians into Brazil and Argentina, or other groups whose international movements were facilitated by the prior conquests of others. Cultural effects on the conquerors. The cultural consequences of conquests have not been limited to the effects of the conquerors on the conquered peoples, nor have the conquerors always had a more advanced culture, as they themselves sometimes recognized by absorbing the cultures of those they subjugated. Sometimes they were biologically absorbed by the conquered people, as the Normans were eventually absorbed by the English, and as various conquerors were absorbed by the Chinese. While conquering peoples have sometimes brought a more advanced technology, or more highly organized economic, political, and social systems than those known to the conquered peoples, at other times the conquerors have prevailed by sheer force of numbers, or by military skill, over peoples otherwise more advanced than themselves. This was true of many conquerors who came out of Central Asia, most famously the hordes of Genghis Khan, but also the founders of the Ottoman Empire, among others, to conquer more civilized societies around them, whether in China, the Middle East, or Eastern Europe. While the conquest of ancient Britain by the Romans was clearly the triumph of a people more advanced in every way, the conquest of China by the Manchus marked the rise to power of a people who themselves acknowledged Chinese cultural superiority, and who strove to acquire and preserve that culture. Likewise, the Roman Empire both absorbed and spread the culture of the Greeks it conquered. While barbarians repeatedly encroached militarily on civilized societies over a period of millennia, culturally it was civilization which encroached upon barbarian society, as the products of civilization and the comforts of civilized life seduced many of the barbarian conquerors into settling down into a new way of life. And these products and this way of life to some extent diffused outward towards others, who still led primitive and nomadic existences. Like other cultural diffusions, this one was selective. Many of the agricultural techniques of civilizations that developed in river valleys were inapplicable in the steppes and deserts of Central Asia. But even where various aspects of civilization were available to be adopted, not all were equally attractive to peoples from another cultural background. Metal weapons, cloth, and gold, for example, were far more likely to be appealing than mathematics. Sometimes the very military success and political overlordship of the conquerors led to preoccupation with military prowess, to the detriment of other kinds of achievement, and to a general arrogance which blinds them to the growing achievements and growing power of others, ultimately to their own detriment. Where a conquering people has long channeled its energies into military prowess and into the skills and talents of rule, including the petty dominion of bureaucratic functionaries. Its attitudes toward the more mundane economic activities left to the subject peoples can also be affected. These economic activities, which ultimately feed, clothe, and house everyone, as well as providing economic support for military conquest, have often been disdained by the conquering people, as among the Spaniards and the Portuguese, both in Europe and the Western Hemisphere, and among the Ottoman Turks. The conquering Mongols in Asia likewise left commerce and production to the conquered peoples. It is not simply that vital economic activities may be left to others, but that such activities are actively disdained by the conquering people, even those of modest means. Among the Ottomans, for example, whole occupations were stigmatized as the occupations of infidels, and the development of such fields was correspondingly neglected, to the ultimate detriment of the empire. In medieval and early modern Spain, a similar disdain countenanced the expulsions of whole peoples, hundreds of thousands of Moriscos, as well as hundreds of thousands of Jews, both of whose lost skills were a blow to the economy. "Who will make our shoes now?" asked the Archbishop of Valencia, after the Moriscos had been expelled, despite his own support of the expulsions. The arrogance so often accompanying conquest has likewise led conquering peoples to disdain and underestimate the achievements of other nations, including rival powers and rival civilizations. For centuries, the armies of the Ottoman Empire had repeatedly defeated and routed the armies of Europe on the battlefields, had spread their power up through the Balkan Peninsula to the very gates of Vienna, and had comparable cultural advantages over Europe in various fields. After centuries of such preeminence, the Ottomans and the Islamic world in general disdained to learn enough about, or from, the rising civilizations of Europe to prevent Europe's eventual turning of the tide against them and subsequent European subjugation of Muslims. One small but common example of the arrogance of conquerors has been their refusal to learn the languages of the conquered peoples, while forcing the latter to learn their language. It was more than two centuries after the Norman conquest of England before there was a king of England who spoke more than a few words of English. Laws and parliamentary proceedings were in French, which was also the language of social discourse among the aristocracy, while the English language and culture remained that of the masses and of the lesser gentry. In other societies as well, the elite among the conquered people have often adopted the language and culture of the conquerors in order to become part of the new elite, even as junior partners. Thus, in a later era, English spread around the world as the language of the educated classes among the conquered peoples in the British Empire, continuing as the world's most widely spoken language long after the empire itself had disappeared. Similarly, French became the language of the elites, and eventually of the masses, in the French Empire in Africa and the Caribbean, while Spanish and Portuguese became the dominant languages in Latin America. In the Soviet Union, only 3% of Russians spoke another language, and even among the millions of Russians living in the Central Asian republics, fewer than 10% spoke one of the Central Asian languages. Yet more than half of all the non-Russians in the Soviet Union spoke Russian, usually in addition to their own native language. Because absorption of the language and culture of the conquerors typically begins with the elite among the conquered peoples, this has created or widened divisions among the indigenous population. Sometimes the division has been not so much by social class as by geographical location, with those located near the foreign cultural centers or spheres of military or economic concentration being the first to absorb the foreign language and culture, with those in the hinterlands continuing the older speech and customs. Thus, in Africa during the era of European colonialism, Africans located in and around the colonial capital or in the principal ports would tend to begin speaking English or French, as the case might be, and to become Christians, while those back in the interior bush country retained their indigenous languages and indigenous religions. Similarly, people living in the Scottish lowlands became Anglicized long before the Highlanders, among whom Gaelic continued to predominate in the 18th century and still had not completely died out in the early 19th century. However, just as a conquering people can be biologically absorbed when they are greatly outnumbered by the conquered, so the culture of the conquerors can be absorbed in the local culture, which then moves up the social ladder. Thus, the English language absorbed many French words during the era of the Norman domination of England, but English ascended the social scale at the same time, with Chaucer's Canterbury Tales being a landmark as the first literary classic written in the English language. The country's laws and parliamentary proceedings began to be written in English in the next century. The intermarriage of the Normans with the English also began at the lower levels and rose up the social scale, until eventually even kings of England began to marry English women. In short, there has been no single pattern for the cultural diffusions which occur as a result of conquests. Sometimes it is the conqueror's culture which prevails, sometimes that of the conquered, but seldom does either prevail unmodified. What is clear, however, is that such diffusions are common, widespread, and historic in their consequences. One small sign of how thorough these cultural consequences can be is that few, if any, words survive in the English language today from the language of the ancient Britons whom the Romans conquered, while words of Latin, Germanic, and French derivation abound in English. Economic consequences. The economic consequences of conquest have been both intentional and unintentional, as well as both positive and negative. The physical destruction and loss of life inseparable from conquest are one obvious cost to the economy. The turmoil of protracted wars imposes further costs in the form of reduced economic activities in places subject to military operations and reduced investments in general, when the unknown outcome of military conflicts makes returns uncertain and hoarding wealth in the economically unproductive form of gold or jewels more and more attractive. Yet successful conquests that put an end to years or generations of sporadic marauding across a vulnerable borderland can make a major contribution to economic activity in places where no one would have dared to farm or build before. Thus, even after the European conquerors in Rhodesia took over large amounts of the best land for themselves, the Africans nevertheless had more land to use than before, since they could now live in places where it would have been suicidal to settle when intertribal hostilities raged. Conquests have been undertaken to exploit the natural resources of other lands, to extort tribute, including slaves, from the conquered peoples, to settle part of the conqueror's population in conquered lands, to establish strategic military bases abroad, or for a variety of other reasons. While economic objectives have long figured among the principal causes for conquest, the reductionist notion that economic motives can be automatically inferred behind conquests of the modern capitalist era is ironically applied to a period, the 19th and 20th centuries, when non-economic influences were especially strong, particularly in the case of the conquest of much of sub-Saharan Africa. European officials responsible for the public treasury were often opposed to the development of a colonial empire in Africa, which they correctly saw as having little capacity to repay the cost of conquest, except in unusual situations, such as the Congo or South Africa, with their valuable mineral resources. Europe's economic impact on Africa was far greater than Africa's economic effect on Europe. Contrary to various economic theories of imperialism, Africa was not a major outlet for European investment or exports. In the early 20th century, Britain's investments in Canada alone were larger than its investments in Africa and India put together, and more British money went to the United States than to Canada. France and Germany were likewise reluctant to sink much of their money into Africa. Commercial trade with Africa was similarly trivial for the economies of the European imperial powers. On the eve of the First World War, Germany exported more than five times as much to a small country like Belgium as to its own colonial empire, which was larger than Germany itself. France likewise exported 10 times as much to Belgium as to all its vast holdings in Africa. Out of Germany's total exports to the world, less than 1% went to its colonies in Africa. Africa was somewhat more significant to Europe as a source of imports, though most of these imports to Europe from Africa came from relatively few places, such as the South African gold mines and diamond fields, or West Africa's cocoa and palm oil regions. Overall, Britain received less than 7% of its imports from Africa, less than from any other continent, including thinly populated Australia. Nor were African colonies usually important sources of profit to European investors or of revenue to European governments. German colonies, for example, in the years leading up to World War I, consistently absorbed expenditures greatly exceeding the revenues raised within the colonies, with taxpayers in Germany having to make up the difference. In the private economy, of 19 firms owning sisal plantations in German colonies, only 8 paid dividends. Only 4 out of 22 firms with cocoa plantations paid dividends, as did only 8 out of 58 rubber plantations, and only 3 out of 48 diamond mining companies. Viewed from Africa, however, the situation looked quite different. While trade with Africa was a small part of the total international trade of the European colonial powers, Trade with these powers was a substantial proportion of the total international trade of the African colonies. Moreover, African exports and imports grew substantially during the colonial era. In German East Africa, for example, exports of peanuts, rubber, cocoa, coffee, and sisal all grew several-fold in the relatively brief period from 1905 to 1913. Similarly, dramatic increases in exports from British, French, and Belgian colonies in Africa occurred between 1938 and 1958. Correspondingly, Africa had rising imports, as well as more consumption of locally produced goods, both raising the living standards of Africans. Real consumption in the Belgian Congo, for example, rose 77% between 1950 and 1958. In addition, the European impact on colonial Africa included creation of virtually the whole modern industrial and commercial sectors of many African countries. Europeans also introduced new agricultural crops and new farming techniques, as well as creating the modern infrastructure of roads, harbor facilities, rail lines, telegraphs, motor transport, and the like. One small indication of what this meant economically is that a single railroad boxcar could carry as much freight as 300 human beings, the usual method of transport in much of Africa, and could cover in 2 days a distance that could take a caravan 2 months. These benefits were by no means without high costs. In addition to deaths from military action during the initial conquests, and often later bloody suppressions of uprisings, there were numerous abuses, injustices, and even atrocities committed against Africans by the conquerors. Forced labor was one of the most widespread and most deeply resented of the chronic abuses to which conquered Africans were subjected. The conditions of this forced labor, like everything else, varied greatly from colony to colony and from time to time. However, even among contract laborers, conditions could be dire. In the Portuguese colony of Angola, during the closing decades of the 19th century, no contract laborer who went to São Tomé was ever known to have returned alive. After an uprising of the Herero people in German Southwest Africa in 1904 had begun, with a massacre of 123 Europeans, a German general ordered his soldiers to kill every Herero, armed or unarmed, whether men, women, or children. An estimated 60,000 out of 80,000 Herero were in fact killed before the general was recalled to Berlin. Many factors went into the decisions to acquire colonies in Africa, with the economic factor not necessarily being dominant in either the acquisition or maintenance of those colonies. Particular individuals such as Cecil Rhodes might make fortunes in the colonies and represent their gains as gains to the nation, even if the taxpayers back home lost more than the European entrepreneurs and the colonies gained. In the case of Africa, powerful missionary lobbies in London pushed the British government into more and more involvement in African affairs, often over the opposition of colonial and treasury officials, and initial attempts at limited involvement often led to being drawn deeper and deeper into unforeseen circumstances requiring wider and wider military and political commitments. What made all this possible, not only for Britain but for other European colonial powers as well, was that the resources required to take over large areas of Africa were relatively small compared to what was available to the European governments. As one historian of warfare has noted, 1 month of a European war cost more than a year of colonial war. When maintaining control of African colonies became more costly as independence movements there gained momentum after World War II, the continent was abandoned as swiftly as it had been conquered. In the relatively few cases where a sustained and determined effort was made to hold on to a colony seeking independence, or to maintain a local European hegemony in the face of indigenous uprisings, it was typically where a substantial expatriate European community in the colonies was unwilling to leave or reluctant to share power, as in Algeria and Rhodesia. In short, there was little to suggest that African colonies had sufficient economic value to the imperial nation as a whole to put up a real fight to hold on to them. The impact of Europe on Africa, for good and evil, was relatively brief as history is measured, about 3 generations, as compared to the centuries in which the Romans ruled Britain or Imperial China ruled parts of Southeast Asia, or the Muslims ruled parts of Europe. Just as the 1880s saw the beginning of the European scramble for Africa, so the 1960s saw their massive withdrawal. This withdrawal began in the northern tier of Muslim states in the 1950s, when Libya, Morocco, and Tunisia became independent, then spread rapidly southward over the next 2 decades as Nigeria, Tanzania, Uganda, the Congo, Kenya, and other black nations achieved their independence. Much as the withdrawal of Roman rule from Britain led to widespread retrogressions, so in many parts of Africa, the departure of the European rulers was followed by technological breakdowns, failing economies, and political chaos marked by military coups. Although the modern capitalist era might seem to be one in which economic motives for imperialism would predominate, in fact, the imperialism of this era was more fleeting and less culturally penetrating than that of medieval or ancient times. One reason was that the modern capitalist era coincided with the rise of democratic politics in the leading European powers, opening the government to a variety of conflicting influences and interests. Moreover, a purely capitalist view of the costs and benefits of conquest would make most conquests simply not worth the money. It was, after all, Adam Smith, the father of laissez-faire economics, who urged his fellow Britons to abandon the American colonies and any other colonies that would not pay their own way. Such non-economic motives as national glory, political power, ideological struggles, and religious crusades have promoted conquests that could not have been sustained on the basis of economic cost-benefit analysis alone. Enormous costs have been imposed on the subject peoples, and to some extent on the economy of the country as a whole, in pursuit of political objectives. Stalin's deliberately created famine in the Ukraine in the 1930s cost the lives of millions of human beings, who, even aside from humanitarian considerations, could have been contributing to the Soviet economy. Yet this operation was a political success in terms of breaking the back of Ukrainian opposition to the Soviet program. As one Soviet official explained at the time, "A ruthless struggle is going on between the peasantry and our regime. It's a struggle to the death. This year was a test of our strength and their endurance. It took a famine to show them who is master here. It has cost millions of lives, but the collective farm system is here to stay. We've won the war." Politically motivated behavior can ignore costs much more readily than economically motivated behavior. Subjugation is not free, even to those who subjugate, quite aside from its costs to the victims. Thus, the imperialism of the modern era, though able to span the globe because of unprecedented wealth and technology, was almost ephemeral by comparison with the empires of earlier times, when Rome ruled the subject peoples of Western Europe for centuries, and China ruled its subjects in Southeast Asia for more than 1,000 years. The speed with which modern colonies were abandoned when they became troublesome is much more characteristic of the capitalist era than the fact that such colonies were acquired in the first place. The rise of democratic and humanitarian principles may also have reduced the ability of imperialist powers to suppress their subject peoples in the way that Stalin suppressed the Ukrainians. Biological consequences. The consequences of conquest are not only cultural, political, and economic, but genetic and epidemiological as well. Vast numbers of men moving through a new era tend to leave behind large numbers of women pregnant with biologically mixed babies, and to exchange diseases with the general population. Diseases have often killed far more soldiers than warfare. Typhus, for example, killed 17,000 of the 20,000 Spanish soldiers lost in the siege of Granada in 1490, and more than 10 times as many French soldiers died of exposure and deprivation during Napoleon's campaign in Russia as died in combat. The indigenous population of the Western Hemisphere was all but exterminated by their sudden exposure to the diseases of Europe and Africa, far more so than by the military campaigns which occupy so much of history. It has been estimated that the U.S. Army killed a grand total of approximately 4,000 American Indians in more than 2 decades of fighting in the middle of the 19th century. Diseases had a far more devastating impact. Smallpox, malaria, influenza, and other diseases brought from Europe and Africa decimated the indigenous population within a few generations before their surviving remnants acquired biological immunity. The 19th century American Indian population of the United States was only about 1/4 of what it had been before the white man arrived, and only in the 20th century has it regained the numerical level of pre-Columbian times. The vulnerability of American Indians to the diseases of Europe and Africa produced even more extraordinary devastation in other parts of the hemisphere. The indigenous population was virtually annihilated in the Caribbean. The indigenous Indian population of Peru declined by approximately 90% after the Spanish conquest. In Brazil, the present-day American Indian population is estimated at less than 5% of the Indian population when the Europeans arrived. This was part of a more general pattern of a devastating impact of European diseases on indigenous populations during the era of European colonization around the world, as well as the impact of local diseases on the European conquerors. Independence and its aftermath. Conquest, whatever its benefits, has seldom been a condition relished by the conquered. The struggle for freedom has been as pervasive throughout history as conquest itself. Conquered peoples have acquired their freedom in a wide variety of ways. A fundamental distinction must be made between those countries which wrested their freedom from a determined and vigorous colonial power, as the Americans did, and peoples to whom freedom came largely as a byproduct of political decisions made by others elsewhere. The latter was the pattern of Roman Britain, of various Central and Southeastern European nations after World War I, and of many Third World nations who received their independence after World War II. It is one thing for a colony to achieve nationhood as a result of its own internal economic development, military strength, and political cohesion. It is another for it to find itself free without these achievements. While Britain was clearly one of the most developed and advanced nations in the world at the time of the American Revolution, there was no huge cultural gap between Britons and Americans, who were at that point largely transplanted Britons. Americans were quite capable of maintaining both the economic and political structures inherited from the colonial era, and eventually of developing both in new directions. No such capability had existed in 5th century Britain when the Romans withdrew to defend the threatened empire on the continent, nor in many Third World countries that were freed in the post-World War II era. The inability of the early Britons to maintain the economic and cultural level left by the Romans was paralleled by their inability to maintain a national government, or to maintain a strong military defense against successive waves of marauders and invaders from continental Europe. A number of nations in Eastern, Central, and Southeastern Europe likewise achieved independence after the First World War as a byproduct of the dismemberment of the defeated Austro-Hungarian Empire by the victorious Western Allies, rather than as a result of their own strength or cohesion. While able to survive economically, often largely as a result of the skills of German, Jewish, and other minorities, they were far less viable militarily, and later ended up being picked off, one by one, by Hitler in the late 1930s. Austria and Czechoslovakia were taken over by military threat and internal subversion even before World War II started, and Poland collapsed almost immediately after the attack which began that worldwide conflagration. Any such threats or attacks on the Austrians or the Czechs in an earlier era would have encountered the formidable Austro-Hungarian Empire, rather than a series of small and individually vulnerable nations. Those sympathetic to the plight of conquered peoples have often tended to idealize them. But this tendency to idealize conquered peoples sometimes has had the dangerous consequence not only of overestimating their economic, political, or military viability, but also of underestimating their capacity for oppression and violence against their own minorities. The history of newly independent nations formed from the dismembered Austro-Hungarian Empire after World War I showed a general pattern of escalating anti-Semitism. The escalating discrimination and oppression against the Chinese in Southeast Asia, the Indians in East Africa, and the Lebanese in West Africa after post-World War II independence swept through these regions repeated a similar pattern, as have later outbreaks of savage ethnic violence and civil war in territories once part of the Soviet Union or of Yugoslavia. Often it has been claimed that a divide-and-conquer strategy of the imperialist power is responsible for intergroup antagonisms. But in many cases, these antagonisms antedated the arrival of the imperialists and burst forth with renewed fury after their departure. A related claim is often made that national boundary lines drawn by conquerors have not coincided with cultural and ethnic lines, but have artificially divided peoples from their brethren who reside in adjoining territory made part of another nation. In much of the world, however, there are no lines that could possibly have been drawn that would have coincided with natural ethnic, linguistic, or cultural divisions. Centuries of migrations, conquests, and the emergence of widely scattered ethnic enclaves, interspersed among one another, as well as varying degrees of assimilation, have produced such a cultural maelstrom as to defy unscrambling. What a distinguished historian said of the Balkans could be said of many other parts of the world, that drawing political boundaries through this ethnic confusion with fragmented peoples and uncertain loyalties would have been a matter of the gravest difficulty even if there had been goodwill on all sides, which there never was. For better or worse, conquests have shaped much of the cultural and racial history of the world.